A governor's 1,000-day extravaganza, spinning personal income, honest non-transparency, and Dr. Seuss's prophecies come true. This is Last Impressions 34, and I'm still Justin Katz. So, Rhode Island Governor Gina Raimondo's 1,000th day in office has come and gone, and I have to say, you know, apart from being mildly sad at the fact that this milestone will never come again, other than that, I mean, I just don't feel very different in any way. I mean, what happened? The 1,000th day seems a lot like the 999th day, right? Anyway, in advance of the event, I wrote about how Raimondo's stops around the state didn't seem quite appropriate. I mean, for one thing, she stopped at Handrigan Seafood in Galilee down in Point Judith, where I worked in college. And, you know, these are guys mainly who don't have a whole lot of options, and they're not necessarily in a position to capitalize on government programs that get you the skills, retool you, as I've complained, she says. She ended the day having an ice cream social with foster kids, which is great until you reflect on the problems that the DCYF, the Department of Youth, Children and Families, under her and before her, to be fair, had with kids and foster kids, losing track of them, even some deaths. One thing that struck me, though, in the Providence Journal coverage of the governor's visit to my old doc stomping grounds, Handrigan, was there was a picture of the governor, a woman, shaking the hand of a woman with two women in the background, and there was some young guy off to the side. But it just, I don't know, it seemed kind of weird having spent some time in that environment. I mean, the woman with whom she was shaking hands, it said she worked in the industry. It didn't say necessarily that she's a dock worker or a fisherwoman. She did have on the orange coveralls, which I used to have, and I wish I still did. But when I stopped living in my fraternity, I just left them there because I was almost as a show of confidence, I was never going to need them again. I actually went back for some other reason. I went back to campus a few years ago, and I checked around in the basement to see if they were still there, but somebody must have spotted them for the valuable asset that they were, and I should have known when I was a dumb college kid. But, you know, I would think over 15 years or so, somebody would say, hey, what's this doing sitting around here? And it would have been kind of awkward for me to take it. You know, I'm taking this back now, 15 years later. These are mine. I almost envision her, this woman, doing like working in the office. Not to say that there aren't women who do the fishing and work on the docks. There are, and they're good at their jobs. But it's not common. You know, if you were to throw a dart at a list of people who work on the docks, you're unlikely to hit a woman who has cause to wear the overall. So I'm probably being unfair to her, but I had this vision of them, you know, Raimondo's PR folks going into the office and saying, hey, could we throw some orange overalls on her to send her down to shake the governor's hand for a picture? I mean, that's the kind of sense you get from a lot of what this governor does. And, you know, it's kind of a shame because just as her contest, you know, the Governor for a Day essay contest that's only open to Rhode Island school girls, not boys, that kind of photo op could make a guy wonder, well, are these programs really meant to benefit me? It reminds me kind of when you see business advertisements that are entirely non-white, despite the actual clientele of the company. But this is actually worse because it's the government. And it contributes to this sort of sense, I think, that the people who govern us, they don't actually want to deal with us as we are, you know, but this workforce is awfully male. And, you know, they've got all kinds of social issues. Some of them are on drugs. Some of them as I've said before, won't marry their significant others despite children, because that would lower their welfare. Maybe they're not especially ambitious people, which is one of the reasons they're working in low-end jobs. You know, that's not an easy picture that the governor can proclaim a program, you know, and say we're fixing things. And there's no government program for that. It's a cultural thing, and at most the government needs to stay out of it. But rather, it's much better to work under some politically correct ideal, and then you can have programs that address that and get good photo ops that play well with your donor base in Illinois, you know, that kind of thing, right, Governor? You got me? But what I was thinking about the 1,000 days was that it would kind of make for a funny skit in like a Saturday Night Live vein, you know, and it's one of those things I often see have these thoughts that I wish I had time and resources to flesh them out. But it would be great to have a video of Governor Raimondo's actual 1,000 days. I mean, so maybe she could have, to start the day, she could have flown to that island, to Iceland, to that building they used in her cooler and warmer ad, you know, and said it was in Rhode Island. That would have been a great way to start it. my first 1,000 days, here I am starting in Iceland, you know, because the sun comes up sooner over there. Maybe there could be a skit of her standing in line with the folks waiting, whose lives have been disrupted by the Unified Health Infrastructure Project, UHIP, you know, and they've been unable to get government services for months and months. And maybe that would have been a good scene. And, you know, in a 1,000-day skit, she could have hung out with them, maybe had some coffee and talked about how, you know, you can't get ahead when your government won't give you your welfare benefits on time. It'd probably be kind of over the line to have a scene where she visits a grave of some child who died in DCYF. That might be over the line. But, I mean, hey, you know, some people are into really, really dark comedy, so maybe you could throw something in for those people. But what really made me chuckle was not something out of her, an idea out of her 1,000 days, but, you know, maybe she could end up in Providence, you know, and go to a club and there would be a brawl and maybe she would be mugged. I've been seeing a lot of Providence Journal stories about that. Maybe they're just covering it more. Maybe I just happened to notice them by chance. I looked at that place on the page in a few times and noticed it, but it seems to be happening more often. So maybe she could end up at a club in Providence and get mugged or something. What makes it really funny, I mean, that's also not a very humorous idea, although, you know, it could be done tastefully, right? But what makes me laugh about it is the governor was on Newsmakers talking to Tim White and Ted Nesi, and for some reason at the end, Tim White brought in at the end saying, hey, Ted Nesi's getting married soon, and the governor joked that she bought a new dress for the wedding, and I actually confirmed with Ted that she is not invited. But I, ever since I heard that, I've been imagining that Governor Raimondo dances like, you know, like Elaine in Seinfeld, where everybody, she doesn't even know it, but everybody's standing back and with faces, some mix between amazement and disgust, because she's just doing these weird jerky dance moves with the feet kicking and her thumbs up like she's hitchhiking violently, and that's her off rhythm, and that's the Elaine dance. So I don't know, we could have a poll. I mean, I wouldn't be surprised if Governor Raimondo dances like Elaine Bennis in Seinfeld. Of course, you know, she could be an excellent ballroom dancer for all I know, or maybe, you know, like flash dance or something. She's an 80s kid in that regard, I guess. But speaking of a more honest spotlight on the governor, spin, get it? Spinning, dancing. Sorry. She was on Rhode Island Public Radio's political roundtable, and she said something, and it's actually a series of talking points, a collection of talking points, if you will, that I've heard. I think she said it on Newsmakers as well. And so whenever anybody asks her about the budget deficits, this seems to be her response. So first, she blames tax cuts and says, we've chosen to cut taxes, and that takes revenue off the table, and now we've got to find cuts to do it. And then She says this.
This economy is stronger than it's ever been. It's, you know,
is that due to Trump's presidency?
No, it's true to my governorship. No, that's, you know,
no, but I mean, Wall Street is at an all-time record.
You walked into that, as my son would say.
The Fed has stopped the quantitative easing. They obviously have.
No, look. In 2014, when most of the rest of America was out of the recession, Rhode Island had the highest unemployment rate in America. We have made huge strides in our economy right here in Rhode Island in the past 2.5 years. And as a result, our personal income tax collections is up. Where we're lagging is corporate tax. And that is because of Trump's presidency, because very wealthy people and corporations are not paying their taxes because they're waiting for Trump to, you know, cut them at the federal level. And so they're holding back.
So, you know, being wonky, and also because it's a quantifiable, verifiable statement, I honed right in on these her suggestions about taxes. And so, you know, yes, it's true, income tax collections are significantly or comfortably above the estimates that the state government used when budgeting this year, but they're a little lower than they were last year at this time. So it's, you know, it's not a clear picture. I mean, if she wants to go back to before her governancy, yeah, of course income tax has gone up from then. There's been a national recovery to some extent, but so are corporate income taxes. So, you know, statistically, what she says isn't entirely untrue. I mean, business taxes are down from last year and from estimates. And some of that may be companies hedging against the unknown. And that's not just President Trump, but also the Federal Reserve and what they might do. Also, if the market's hot, they might not be cashing in their investments. So there isn't this generation of income that might, but maybe they're investing somewhere other than Rhode Island. I think that's probably a big piece of the discussion that we have to consider. But this attempt, I mean, the attempt to spin a subject like this in order to find some way that she can take credit for the good while blaming the president for the bad, it's just, I don't know, it's just in a way unseemly. Insulting almost. It's almost like saying, well, let me just, if I can say this like it sounds rational enough, you stupid people will believe me, right? That's kind of the feeling I get from it. But what makes it, particularly this week, hearing that, what makes it kind of rankle on me is that the Rhode Island Center for Freedom and Prosperity, for which I work as research director, does this jobs and opportunity index I designed a couple of years ago. And it's, the idea is that it's supposed to be flesh out the economy and all this government data that's put out there, federal data for the most part, that supposedly tells us how the economy is doing. And so you get the employment and unemployment, which is honestly, it's just a joke. I mean, the unemployment rate, it doesn't tell you much. If you could drive people out of your work labor force because your economy is so bad, your unemployment rate will go down. I mean, that's kind of a useless metric. At least nowadays. And even employment, you know, the numbers are wildly they fluctuate, and the revisions every year make the economy seem worse in Rhode Island. And it's surveys based on, you know, relatively small numbers of people. It still has some employment data, still has surveys, employment surveys still have some utility. So we use them in the Job as an Opportunity Index, which we call JOI. But it also factors in other things. So, for example, my favorite of the three factors is the prosperity factor, which is personal income divided by state, local, and federal taxes collected. So if your income goes up, you improve by this metric. If your taxes go down because it's in a denominator, you improve by this metric. And stuff like that really gives you, a more thorough understanding of how the economy and even the society is doing in Rhode Island. Another of the factors is employment and jobs over three common welfare programs: Medicaid, TANF, which is welfare, and SNAP, which is food stamps. So that's really people who are working over people who are receiving welfare benefits. And obviously, it's not a one-to-one correlation, but we're comparing Rhode Island to itself over time and to other states. So the ratio is what's important. So it doesn't much matter that one person might be fit in all five of those categories, both jobs and employment and all three welfare benefits. That it's just up and down. If that one person loses the job, then that will affect the rating in a way that I think is helpful and clear. But the reason I bring that up in this context is that Rhode Island actually fell to 49th in the country when I ran numbers this week. So when my numbers start in 2005, we were 42nd by this metric. And by 2012, we were down to 48th. And we held that 48th. We were there for 5 years. Now we just now dropped to 49th in the country, just Delaware, keeping us above the bottom, so to speak. And which is really, really a stark place to be, because New Hampshire is frequently, often number one. I mean, the index doesn't change too much, but from month to month. But sometimes Wyoming, or I think it is, but some other state will unseat New Hampshire. But that's the range we have in New England. New Hampshire number one on this index, and Rhode Island last. And we didn't design it that way. We decided what metrics we should use and how we ought to offset them against each other in order to come up with a measure. And it just happened that New Hampshire is tops by this measure. And it's really telling. But in the context of Raimondo's remarks, what's especially notable is part of the reason we slipped to 49th was that personal income annualized, so 4 quarters worth of personal income, fell by 1.5%. That's $679 million. It's dropped. And this is a national metric, so everybody else would be having the same issues. At the same time as that, though, state and local taxes increased by about 0.5%, by $20 million on an annualized basis. So they're collecting more taxes, but the income is falling. And that's an indication of taxation issues, not an indication of economic issues. It's not an indication that we need to find cuts to offset tax cuts. We need to cut taxes to have revenue. We have to cut taxes to allow people to have revenue and income. So, you know, the index is very slow moving and more accurate, which doesn't serve, well, spin in either direction. You know, we almost, to those who have a bias wanting bad news so they can force some change in Rhode Island, it's really a slow, like, are we there yet? Have we fallen yet? Come on. But it's meant to be a fair index, and with perhaps someday, you know, with, to expand nationally if other people discover it and like it. So the governor's spin is just, it's false. It's dishonest in a way, assuming she knows the degree to which it's false. But one area, though, in which I'd say we are getting more honesty in Rhode Island lately is with the processes of government. You know, because in both the General Assembly and the executive branch, it's almost like the insiders aren't even inclined to care, to pretend about decorum or rules. You know, whatever. We'll just rewrite it. We'll be transparently corrupt, basically. The latest example of this, which I think is great, comes from the Department of Transportation Director, Peter Alviti, who was on the Matt Allen show and spent a lot of time filibustering Matt, who said he had a lot of comments. But I think this part shouldn't slip by folks' awareness.
And so this complaint being brought by the gentleman from John Vitt, who we know from the Secunda River Bridge controversy, yep. He wants to find out why the big ruckus with him. Why did you just give him the information he wanted? Why is he going to the AG's office?
Well, here was the problem with that. So he had done some preliminary estimates on what we thought it was going to cost, and you know how things go like in the public, right? Yeah. Preliminary estimates and drafts are not by law mandated to be turned over in APRA requests.
Right.
Okay.
You don't have to do it.
You don't
but you
have
can.
To. You can. So we had a debate. Is it going to serve the public interest to get an estimate, which is incorrect because it's not what it ended up costing, or into the hands of somebody that we knew would probably use it for political rhetoric or whatever. Whatever they're going to use it for. Or whatever kind of rhetoric.
So just for anybody who doesn't happen to know, John Vitt his Vitkovec, his last name, was trying to find out how many of these signs that, well, basically the roadwork signs, are they put them out there well in advance of road projects and pick them up well after with green or red dots, you know, whether the project's on budget or on time. An okay idea, but how many are there, these ugly blue signs that are not even out there? I mean, accountability would be putting them out there as you start the project so people know what's going on, and then picking them up when the project ends, not leaving them there, not advertising coming in the year 2042, you know, that coming right after the governor's next election, you know, that kind of thing. And then you add on a governor's name and it seems kind of suspicious, right? So John asked the Department of Transportation, how many of these signs do you have and how much do they cost? So that's what Peter Alviti is talking here, the director of DOT. And he's notice what's implicit in his explanation. He's saying it's an open question whether it's in the public interest to hide information from the public, right? Is it really in the public interest to give as much information as we can to the public? Now, that doesn't sound like transparency to me. We've all had this sense that the Raimondo administration thinks in these terms, that, you know what, it's not so good for me for the public to know this, and what's good for me is good for the public, so it's not in the public interest for me to give you information. In fact, I'm going to make fun of, you know, makes as I did with giving Patricia Morgan, the House Minority Leader, maps from a century ago. We're almost going to thumb our nose at you. That's what's in the public interest, right? But now, here we go. We've got it stated plainly, the director of transportation. We thought about whether to give this stuff, and we said, you know what, this guy's going to use it for political reasons, and it's in the public interest not to have this information come out there. You know what, Mr. Alviti, conflict where two sides keep each other honest in government is in the public interest. All right, just a tip there. But there were a lot of things that bothered me about this interview with Matt Allen. That's the only clip I'm going to play, but because he was so much trying to filibuster and just draw out, and he was very long-winded. So, you know, he made a big deal about how much better the department's management is now about as far as following projects and having somebody who owns the project. But, you know, I did a study on this for the Rhode Island, the Ocean State Current, when Alviti first came into office, and a lot of those suggestions were straight out of a study that were commissioned by the Chafee governor, Governor Chafee, the previous administration. And so it's not like they came in with these brilliant managerial ideas. The government has said we had a problem, and they hired people to come in and tell them how to fix it. And they're to some degree following that plan. Now, what's interesting is the areas in which they're not following that plan. So Alviti, for example, the plan from the private contractors, and I've forgotten their name by this point, I apologize, was to hire more type project management types and engineer types to get projects ready to go, and then mainly to farm out the work to companies that can work off of a plan. Alviti changed that to benefit, because he came into government from the laborers union. He changed this plan, and I think, if I'm remembering correctly, in the original plan, there would have been 40 new hires and some non-union, and one would have been in a laborers union. They switched it. Almost all of them, I think, were laborers from the laborers union, and a lot of them are doing things like making these signs or striping roads, which they used to farm out. So, you know, the whole management thing is another area of slick talk. And also, Alviti gives this long, long answer on how they settled on tolling just trucks. And he goes, rather than every vehicle, he goes through this, oh, well, okay, step one, we need new revenue. Well, all right, I'll let that go. But of course, they didn't. But government could have found revenue elsewhere. And that's one thing that bugged me, too. He said, well, you know what, in government, other people, we needed another 49, 50 million bucks, and you know, other government agencies need that too. So I didn't want to get into where I'm competing with other government agencies. Well, you know, this is what government's supposed to do, is think of, is prioritize. So anyway, So we need new revenue. That's the step one in our thinking. Let's do a user fee because, you know, people are using up our resources. That's step two. Almost sounds like a free market idea. In some regards, I would like that. And so then the next step, well, are you really using it the same amount if you're driving a big vehicle versus a small vehicle? The big vehicles do more damage, so they're using up the resource more. And so on and on and on. And they ran out of time, but the implication was they didn't toll cars because trucks are the ones that use the resource, which is nonsense, right? The cars, even a small vehicle, is using up the resource. Now, you would have to charge them less, right? If you want to do it that way, that'd be fair. But, you know, I just don't buy it. They knew, just like they knew if they gave John Vitt the information he was seeking, there would be public outcry about the cost or this or that, and it would become a political thing. They knew they couldn't sell tolls if it was on every vehicle, including cars, even if it was only a dime on the cars. So they reverse engineered a rationale. This is my opinion. They reverse engineered a rationale just to hit trucks. And here they are with this, oh, well, let me give you my thought process here. I don't know. I don't buy it. So to end on a note of madness, just before, as I was writing my notes for this episode today, I came across the news that the Dr. Seuss Museum in Massachusetts is going to censor a mural because in this field of all kinds of different Dr. Seuss-like characters, there's one guy who's a kind of a stereotypical Chinaman, as somebody 40, 30 years ago, when it was originally drawn, probably would have seen, you know, the bowl of rice to chopsticks, the little angled hat. So this is racist, apparently. And a couple authors were going to boycott an event at this museum because of this mural. So now they're going to basically censor it. They're going to repaint it, I guess, get rid of the Chinese guy. Maybe they'll keep the Arab-looking guy sitting on the elephant. Who knows? Maybe somebody... there's a magician in there. Maybe there's somebody identifies as magicians will be offended by that. It's madness. I mean, he's one of a field of characters. He's part of the character of the scene that Dr. Seuss was probably representing pretty faithfully. I mean, I think of the musical Annie, right, where she's running around in the streets and hiding from the police because she skipped out of her orphanage, and she hides behind some Hasidic Jews, I think it is, and, you know, there are Oriental guys there too, and it's the character of the cityscape that he was conveying. There's nothing racist about it. It's a guy walking through. Maybe it's a stereotype, but you're talking about one picture in a children's book, you know, to convey an idea. You know, stereotypes kind of help in that regard. He's becoming representative of the character type. That's how it works. But of course, this, I don't know if there's a direct relationship, but of course, in the news, chronologically, this follows on recently a Cambridge librarian who snubbed First Lady Melania Trump over the donation of a bunch of Dr. Seuss books. And the woman said, well, that's racist. Dr. Seuss, of course, everybody knows Dr. Seuss is racist. So you take these books back, lady. Just stunning. And Rob Long, talking on the Ricochet podcast, made a point where the humor of the stunning, stunning development, the humor gets sucked right out of it, kind of like my joking about Graves earlier on. But so here's Rob Long on Ricochet.
The one thing that it's funny and hilarious and it's funny, she thinks Dr. Seuss is racist, isn't that crazy? There is one sentence in there that I found profoundly disturbing, and I don't really know yet what I think of it, but there was a sentence in it that said, you know, our class is the books you sent were not diverse. We want to celebrate diversity. Our class is diverse. The students have come from all ethnicities and religions and races and creeds and gender expressions. Gender expressions. These are kindergartners. They're just something so creepy about that. That is where it's suddenly the funny, it's funny, she thinks Dr. Mm-hmm. is racist, what a weirdo, turns dark for me. Where a sudden, what is going on in those class? They're kin to 5 or 6, right? Like, that's crazy. That's a crazy sentence.
So, if we want to be charitable, we could maybe say that this librarian is just indoctrinated, and this is evidence of indoctrination, you know, right? She's not really thinking for herself, so she just recites the diversity mantra, right? You can't make any distinctions within it because you're not thinking for yourself. That's the charitable view, I suppose. And in a bigger way, though, as I said a minute ago, we're just in a time of madness. I mean, to bring this back to Rhode Island, the incident brings to mind two things, and Rob Long's commentary, that is. First, the Department of Education in Rhode Island has just announced that it's going to make its guidance at the urging of activist groups like the poorly named American Civil Liberties Union. They're going to take guidance for transgender students for Rhode Island public schools and make it mandatory through regulation. So it's no longer going to be just a guidance that 25% of schools can decline to follow. It's going to be a regulation. They're going to force schools to follow these rules pushed down from the state. And among those rules are things like tasking teachers and other school faculty to sniff out transgender feelings and start to identify them. And that gets pretty creepy. And even in the younger grades, it says the teacher should work with parents to, as a team, you know, as if they're on equal footing to determine what's best for the children. And then in the area of transgenderism, we're not talking just, you know, here's how we can get this child to know math and do some spelling. This is their identity. The school teachers are going to be on an equal footing in determining that. And that this attitude is what they're is not accidental, is proven when you get to the part of the guidance that it pertains to high school, where they're actively telling teachers and school faculty to help the student come up with a timeline for their gender transformation and, if necessary, hide it from their parents. This is where we're going with this. This is not, like he says, like Rob Long says, this is crazy. This is not civil liberties. This is not, you know, just trying to make sure we can accommodate everybody in a school setting. This is indoctrination. This is just going too far. Now, the other thing, I don't want to end on that note. So the other thing this made me think of, with the gender expression being linked in with all these other isms and s's and this, that the diversity mantra, is that great Dr. Seuss story about sneeches on beaches, and some of them have stars on their belly, and some of them don't. And a salesman comes by and tells the ones without the and of course the ones with the stars think they're superior, and they won't associate with the non-star sneeches. Or I think it's plain belly sneeches, I think is what he calls them. And the salesman comes with a machine and says, "Hey, I can get stars on your belly." So then they're all the same. Hey, this should be great, right? But then the star sneeches are all upset because now they can't figure out who they're supposed to snub. So the salesman sells them for more money, a way to take off the stars, and it just becomes this big battle of stars going on and off and on and off. But what it made me think of, and this is, it's almost like a, all right. Let me say up front, I am imposing this metaphor on this, but it's almost like if you wanted to, you could choose to see this as a sort of a prophetic prediction about the diversity, the cult of diversity. Because, you know, what's a star, really? I mean, where have we seen that in history? You see stars in the Holocaust, and we know that Dr. Seuss was an anti-Nazi kind of guy. So you get the stars, and then that's your adversity. And then, you know, now we're in a position where the government has imposed tolerance to such an extent, you're better off in a lot of ways becoming a protected group so that you're in that litany there are advantages to being in that litany of diverse people who deserve to be respected because of their diversity. So you want that star in a sense. Now, of course, a lot of people, I think, are ignorant even of the Holocaust and World War II. So there's no historical experience. Anybody who wasn't there has no historical experience to really draw on and understand what that was like. I mean, there's distant stuff, say, in the Middle East or elsewhere that has some similarities, but that's all, you know, it's all, like I say, distant, not really affecting us in a way World War II did. And with you know, European Jews trying to come to the country and all that kind of stuff. So people have forgotten the real import. I think, I don't know if it was in a podcast or just wrote about it some weeks ago, about people talking about a Holocaust of animals being abused somewhere. It struck me as inappropriate. But that said, we are in a place where it's almost an advantage. Not almost, it is an advantage in some ways, in some settings, like a college setting, for example, to be a disadvantaged group. It's a source of power. So you want to be able to grab that and say, hey, look, I've got a star. I'm in the in group. If you really want to, you could see Dr. Seuss as prophetic in that regard. I've gone pretty long on this one, so I'll wrap it up. I just want to remind you, you can comment and what have you on the post. Find the links to the podcast I mentioned on the post associated with this on theoceanstatecurrent.com. Also, you can go to iTunes and you can leave feedback there. Give me good reviews and other people might come across this. I'm putting these on ricochet.com now. So if you're a member, or you can go there and like it. And after a few likes, they have to pay some attention to it. So you could do that too. That'd be great. And in the meantime, as I said last week, don't worry so much about first impressions, because you can change them, but last impressions can last for an eternity. God bless.